From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that is accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Katie Mullally. This morning we talk about the science of weed with renowned researcher, physician, and neuroscience professor Godfrey Pearson. Is it a cure-all, a toxic, addictive substance, or something in between? We'll find out. Then, Jasmine Smith, the CEO of Rejuve.ai, joins us. Rejuve AI is a new app now in beta testing that will help you reduce your biological age. How? Well, stay tuned. We'll be back after these messages.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Our next guest is renowned psychiatric researcher, physician, and Yale neuroscience professor Godfrey Pearson. Since the onset of many states legalizing and even normalizing the use of cannabis, we wanted to explore the science behind this plant, or this weed, shall we say. Godfrey Pearson is that researcher who, in fact, has written a book called The Science of Weed. He calls it an indispensable guide to cannabis, and he covers everything from its botany and chemistry to its impacts on psychology and human behavior. Godfrey Pearson, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Lynn and Katie, good morning. Great to be with you.
As we were saying, it's been a while since we've done an interview about cannabis, and I'm just wondering, you know, from those advocates who say it's the panacea, it will cure everything, to those who are maybe still in the just say no camp, what is your approach and what is your take?
Mainly to figure out from a logical and unemotional, or take the emotion out of it, figure out what are the risks and benefits, to do more research, to figure out what's unknown about those questions, and to try and bridge this split that's exactly there, as you say, between people who are staunch advocates for whatever reason, and those reasons may be commercial, and people who are very much against the drug, to try and understand why they're against the drug, because often that's not fueled by reason either. And just to reach some logical conclusion that's away from those two extremes. So what we've tried to conduct some of the research to figure out what the drug actually does in terms of its real effects and what the risks are to different age groups in particular.
Yeah, that's a great place to start. You know, with regard to it being sort of an emotional topic, it seems like controversial topics always become emotional. But looking at a couple of substances, I just found out recently that I have a high sensitivity to turmeric and acai. Okay, so two things that are these panaceas, you know, are these things that people consider very good for you? Well, they're not good for me. But why does it seem that it's a little bit harder for people to say that about something like cannabis, you know, just not good for me? And yet those advocates will continue to, you know, keep pushing it.
Yeah, well, I think you've hit on a really important topic though, which are, there are individual differences in response to different substances that are quite marked, so that I have friends who are immune to the effects of cannabis. They've taken huge doses, and there's something about the distribution of cannabinoid receptors in their brains that makes them, or their pharmacokinetics, the speed at which they break down cannabis substances in their body, that makes them immune to its intoxicant effects. And everyone finds that. So when I've got pain pills after like minor surgery containing opioids, I find the effects of opioids highly unpleasant. So I'd be the world's worst candidate for someone who was an opioid user. Whereas other people have their first taste of an opioid medicine and say, this has been missing my entire life. So huge individual differences, mainly based, I think, on receptor numbers and distributions in people's brains. So we have an endocannabinoid system like we have an opioid system. And pharmacokinetics, the enzymes in our body that are genetically determined that make us break down any particular class of drugs slower or faster, so it hangs around longer or doesn't. So exactly as you say, some people will take cannabis and they'll have a panic attack, or they'll become extremely paranoid. And they're sort of once and done. They find that experience so unpleasant, they'll never do the drug again. Whereas other people say, oh, this is great. This is the substance for me, and everything in between.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're talking with Godfrey Perlson. He and his new book, The Science of Weed, An Indispensable Guide to Cannabis. Well, Godfrey, how long have humans been using and consuming cannabis?
So cannabis use, as far as we can tell from historical records, began in China about 3,000 years ago. And cannabis was one of these Swiss army knife of plants. So people used it because there are strong fibers in the stems that they used for making ropes and cloth material. So the word canvas comes from cannabis. It was used for its nutritious seeds that are still available tonight today, like hemp hulls that people put in their smoothies. Then it was used as a medicine. So the Chinese word ma, the symbol for that is a little cannabis shed that are just two lines with a cross to hang the cannabis plants and dry them, and also as an intoxicant. So people discovered quite early on that there are medical benefits to the plant. And it was used then for exactly the same things that we would use cannabis for now, as an aid in childbirth, for headaches, for pain control, and to calm people down, and for epilepsy. So it's very interesting. The medical uses of cannabis have persisted over thousands of years, pretty much unchanged. And recently in Israel, people found an altar from about 1000 BC that was still had traces of cannabis on it. So, and it was used in early biblical times as a religious intoxicant. And it's been used in India in the Holi festival for at least a couple of thousand years. And people have learned how to use it safely as a religious intoxicant. So it's been around and with us for a very long time.
Were these people able to find cannabis on a global scale? Was it one of those rare plants that you find all across the globe, or did it, transport itself, or not? Was it transported from culture to culture through shipping and trading? Or again, was it something that was found globally already?
So Michael Pollan, the author, has written a lot about this. So it seems to have started somewhere in China. And once people realized the benefits, they took the seeds with them. So it traveled on the Silk Road. It ended up in Japan and in East Asia, and then found its way to Europe. So it's been used for thousands of years also in Europe. Although more recently than in China, mainly for its for rope making, and intoxication came to us much more recently from Egypt through Napoleon's troops in around 1800 when he occupied Egypt. His troops ran out of alcohol, which was not available locally, and discovered that cannabis was, brought it back with them to France. So that's how it reached Europe and then the United States.
Well, let's talk about your book a little bit. The first chapter is on the good science. Oh, sorry. The first chapter is on the good science and bad science. And, as it relates to, can I just bring up for a minute the CBD that you can get at your supermarket checkout stand along with your peanut M&Ms? It's everywhere, and it makes me think about good science and bad science and profit, and when these things are being put out there that aren't scientifically proven, perhaps. But I guess the question would be, what do you consider the good science and the bad science?
So, the CBD that you get in smoothies and sodas and impregnated into sportswear, gives you doses generally around 5 milligrams. If you look at the doses that are prescribed for seizure control, let's say, or have been used to treat schizophrenia, they're doses of like 800 to 1,000 milligrams. So the dose that we're getting in terms of the science question is in most commercial products is so low that it is probably of no benefit or harm whatsoever. The doses that are orders of magnitude smaller than what you'd expect to be therapeutically effective. Mm-hmm. So that's a science question. It's like, what is an appropriate dose for what particular condition? And the answer to that is it almost certainly is much, much higher than what's available in most commercial products.
Well, interesting. And that kind of leads into a question about profit and about sort of, big pharmaceutical companies jumping on the bandwagon, and where can you trust, you know, if you're getting it, where to get it, and is the supermarket shelf next to the M&Ms a good place or a bad place? Do we all need to go to dispensaries where things are more, or are they more regulated?
All right. So you've opened a can of worms there. So one is that, yes, there is big weed, just as there is big tobacco. And their aim, if there is one, is to sell as much product as possible to as many people as possible. So they're going to be emphasizing the benefits and minimizing the harms. Whereas there's a bunch of people who are a combination of killjoys or people who overemphasize the harms, pushing from the other extreme. And where we want to end up is somewhere in the middle, where we can be cognizant of both harms and benefits and minimize harms. So harm minimization is something that really isn't stressed enough. So by making available the information we already have, as well as by doing more research on harms and benefits, that's going to aid us in sort of making those distinctions. But as far as the question about should we just head to our local dispensary, that itself runs into a host of problems. So dispensaries want to also sell you whatever they have on their shelves, and they don't always test for contaminants. So they don't test for molds and heavy metals and bacteria, because they don't want to scare you away from buying their product. They don't always get accurate assays in terms of the cannabinoids that are in the product. So they may send their weed to 5 different labs. Whatever tells them has the highest THC concentration is what they will say is the actual concentration in their plant. And there are no federal standards for any of these things, because cannabis is still illegal at a federal level. So although dispensaries may be variably regulated on a state-by-state basis, and there are huge differences in that, there are no federal regulations. So it's kind of a hodgepodge of well-regulated and very poorly regulated different stores.
Well, speaking of this with this regulation, since it is federally it's an illegal substance, how much legitimate research can be done? You know, is the NIH or Harvard Medical School involved in these studies so you can actually find a legitimate study versus going to Bob's Weed Shop and finding the latest that they got from, you know, whatever lab they use?
So because the FDA still has cannabis or THC as a Schedule I substance, which means it has a high chance of abuse or addiction and no approved medical use, it's very difficult to do research. There's what people call green tape, which is the cannabis equivalent of red tape. So for example, we have to store our cannabis inside of a locked room, inside of another locked room, with an electronic alarm and a video camera, inside of a safe that is bolted 2 feet into concrete in the floor. And that's just to get a single dose of weed out of there to for one of our experiments. So the barriers to doing research in terms of federal bureaucracy are great. And that's discouraged a lot of objective fact finding that should be done from being done. So there are many unanswered questions as far as cannabis, its constituents and what those constituents do, both in terms of benefits and harms, and particularly in certain age groups. So like almost all the research has been done on people 30 and under. So what it does in individuals aged over 65 is a huge blank area. And since people in that age group are among the biggest consumers now of cannabis products for sleep or pain, arthritis control, and so on, that's something we desperately need to know that we have virtually no idea about.
Well, let's talk about the use in those under 30, specifically those under the age 26. I have talked with a friend who's a paramedic, and she was saying that they've seen people, if you take too much cannabis before the age of 26, when you go into that high, it can actually alter your brain permanently. Is that something that you're finding, or is everybody able to come off that high and not have any long-term psychiatric effects?
Yeah, well, this is a prime area of concern. So evidence from this comes partly from animal studies, and partly from epidemiologic studies. Obviously, you can't have the experiment that everyone would want, which is taking a huge city, finding everyone under age 25 or 26, giving half the people cannabis for 15 years, half the people placebo, and watching for differences. So these are whole population observational studies in countries that have really good health records, like Scandinavia. What they seem to show is that if individuals who are adolescents begin cannabis use early and use high doses, so high amounts of THC, and use on a regular basis, they're setting themselves up to have a much higher risk for developing a psychotic illness. So that these would be permanent, long-lasting, chronic psychiatric, psychotic conditions where people have hallucinations and delusions and social deterioration. So that you're raising your odds by about 4 to 5 times seems to be the emerging consensus for a psychotic illness under those circumstances. When the age of risk ends, when that window closes and you can use the drug without that risk, is not well agreed on. Some people think it's in the mid-20s, exactly as you said. Other people think that window closes maybe by age 21. So the evidence is not really clear on that. There are also concerns that there may be long-lasting effects in terms of cognition, so that you're shaving off a few IQ points. And the evidence for that, compared to the evidence for psychosis, is much less. So that whether or not there are permanent cognitive effects is very much in dispute.
Interesting. So I would say I'm one of those people, if I use it, I shave off immediately several IQ points, which is why I don't use it. And again, I'm going back to individual differences and wondering, because I know people who are, you know, extremely bright and very analytical, and they start with it in the morning and they go through all their work day. It helps them with focus and enhances what they're doing. And therefore, you know, maybe they would argue increasing their IQ by a few points. So does the science also then show it is affecting people differently in terms of those types of outcomes?
So again, that's really a great question. So when people are given measured amounts of cannabis under laboratory conditions, there are short-lasting effects on short-term memory. So if you're given a list of 50 words to remember and asked to recall them spontaneously, or given back that list half an hour later with other words that weren't on the original list but are similar, then there are immediate decreases in short-term memory, which is, I think, what you're talking about, and also probably in working memory, the ability to hold things online like a telephone number for a few minutes. But those wear off really quickly and disappear. When we've tested people on tasks related to driving, which we've done a lot in my lab, some effects persist for many hours, like up to 5 to 6 hours after a single acute dose. But in terms of people who say, weed improves my creativity, or I'm a musician and I can see the space in between the notes, or weed calms me down and I can focus more on what I have to do when I'm writing, for example, I totally believe that. That really works for some people. It's just the idea that you can kind of wake and bake, like wake up in the morning, take a hit off a joint and keep smoking all day long. It's probably not good. It's no better for you than taking like sips of Chardonnay all day long just to take the edge off things. It's probably not healthy as opposed to occasional use. So there's this idea of moderation. People who use all day, every day, are much more likely to develop cannabis use disorder and develop addiction problems. So that's like part of the downside of cannabis is that it is an addictive drug for some people. And that addiction is not really severe in that it's not going to kill you as alcohol use disorder can. And if you go cold turkey, it's unpleasant, but not unpleasant in the way that withdrawing from opioids like heroin is unpleasant or alcohol is unpleasant and possibly can kill you. It's somewhere in between quitting coffee and quitting tobacco. It's like unpleasant and lasts for a couple of weeks and then it's gone. But it's sufficiently unpleasant that some people don't want to quit and find it very difficult to quit. Yeah, there are probably 40 million people in the US who have some sort of degree of addiction or dependence from cannabis.
Before I forget, I want to go back to the difference between alcohol use and cannabis use. And among our school children, there is a survey. I don't know if this is a nationwide survey, but it's certainly in our state of Utah, something called the SHARP survey. And it talks about pro-social behaviors and things like addiction. And it is very well designed to have adolescents answer these questions in a way that they can kind of suss out if they're giving a fake answer or not. But what they've found recently is that among adolescents, so these would be school children, I forget at what age it starts, but it's somewhere around junior high and then through high school, that they're finding that kids are using alcohol less, but weed more, and getting a little bit more of lack of, you know, not so much disapproval from their parents on doing so. Just given what you said about increasing 3 to 4 times your propensity for psychosis later on, you know, can you talk a little bit more about that?
What you're seeing in your state is a good reflection of what's being seen nationally, that adolescents are using less alcohol significantly, but interestingly, although they're using slightly more cannabis, they're not using a lot more cannabis. One thing that has changed, though, is harm perception. So that over the last decade, high school students, along with a lot of the population, now see cannabis as a much more harmless drug. And people who see the drug as more harmless are more likely to use it. So once they get out of high school, is you see large increases in sort of 18-year-olds and up. But surprisingly, the use among high school students hasn't jumped in the way that one might expect and in the way that it has in the general population, where use has increased across pretty much every age group, except for people who are in high school, where it stayed really steady.
Well, Godfrey, even though the use hasn't increased, it seems like the potency of cannabis has, because you're seeing all these different strains and different, you know, they're for different purposes. How has the components of cannabis changed since, let's say, from, you know, the ancient Chinese strain?
So cannabis as we have it today as the next a triumph of selected breeding. Just as we want chickens that are more meaty or cattle that are larger and have less fat, we humans have bred the cannabis plant to have a higher THC content so that it's more intoxicating. And that's part of what humans do. We start with a plant like the poppy plant and get out opium and then make morphine from the opium and heroin from the morphine, and then figure out how to make a completely synthetic compound that has the same properties but gives you more bang for your buck. So we've bred cannabis plants to have higher and higher THC concentrations. And when you do that, because of the plant genetics, you're driving down the amount of CBD. That's a necessity based on plant genetics. So that's thing A. But we've also figured out how to extract the THC from the plant in various concentrates. So we started with butane hash, and then we figured how to distill the plant to get almost pure THC out of it. So you can now buy those concentrates in many dispensaries and things that are called shatter or butter that are like 90% plus THC. So tiny amounts of that THC waxes or shatters and the size of a pinhead will get you incredibly intoxicated. And I've observed people do this in cannabis cafes. So they'll have a dab nail and put on one of these concentrated dabs, so-called, in a tiny amount and be incredibly intoxicated from that. So that's readily available now. If you want to use almost pure THC, you can now do that and you don't have to even use the plant anymore. But the plant itself has a lot more THC in it. And people my age who haven't used since the 60s are often surprised and sometimes shocked by how potent these new concentrates are.
Wow. I feel like we could talk to you all day, but we know you have another interview right away. But Godfrey Perlson is our guest and has written a book called The Science of Weed, An Indispensable Guide to Cannabis. So many more questions, but just read the book. Godfrey, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
You're welcome. It was really fun being with you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Now, you've probably heard someone, in fact, we all say this, 50 is the new 40, as a way to suggest age is just a number and we're only as old as we feel. Either way, it's true that candles on a birthday cake are not always reflective of biological age. For those who aim to, you know, Benjamin Button their way through life, a new app is claiming that aging in reverse may become a reality. The company is called Rejuve AI. The company is called Rejuve AI or Rejuve.ai if you'd like to look it up. And joining us now is the CEO of Rejuve AI, Jasmine Smith. She's joining to tell us more about it. Good morning to you, Jasmine. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Katie and I do so many interviews about AI and the advancements in AI, you know, on the one hand, why we should fear AI, on the other hand, why we should welcome it and learn about it. This application of AI sounds very promising. Can you talk about the genesis?
Yeah, so it is. It kind of does go back a little bit because Rejuve AI is actually a spinoff of a larger entity called SingularityNet, which focuses all about making AI kind of democratized and decentralized and kind of preventing the, Terminator scenarios that people are fearing that can come from this technology. So it's putting in kind of beneficial and benevolent values into the AI that we're making. And of course, what better way to do that than to be working on making humans live longer, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So Rejuve AI has been formed as an app. And how is an app going to make me go from
my X age to an X minus 10 age.
So yeah, actually, well, the app is kind of our flagship product, but it is kind of more than that. It's an ecosystem really and a network. So the other kind of name for it is Rejuve Network. And the goal is that the app is kind of the user-facing tool that people are tracking their personal health data and getting the AI-driven insights and recommendations, where it's kind of learning about you and giving you the best kind of pathway forward, you know, to have a reduced biological age, and also informing you of emerging technologies that may be suitable for you as they come along to do even more in that direction than is possible now with, you know, just the supplements and lifestyle kind of a thing. And then on the network side, it's linking you to trusted providers of, you know, supplements, of tests, of consultations, all that, you know, good stuff. So that it kind of demystifies that world a little bit, and connecting you with providers that can assist you as well, because we're not replacing the clinicians, we're assisting.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are talking with CEO of Rejuve AI, Jasmine Smith. This is the company focused on creating a longevity app and helping you work on your biohacking. So we hear biohacking thrown all over the place. Biohack how you get up in the morning, biohack your morning, biohack your lunch, biohack your food. What is biohacking from your perspective and what you guys are working on?
Yeah, so exactly. I mean, right now, biohacking really comes down to a lot of self-experimentation, you know, figuring out what works for you, what doesn't, you know, what you actually are sticking to, and, you know, what's not working so well. And what we want to do with the AI is optimize those protocols for individuals, but then also at a bigger level too, because maybe there are people like you. Like, we want to kind of create, you know, these profile strands of, okay, you know, I'm this age, you know, I eat like this, you know, my exercise habits are this way, you know. There's different dynamics in people's lives. You know, some people have lots of free time, you know, to arrange a schedule. Some people have very little, you know, income levels, all that kind of a thing, to make these kind of best pathways forward to be a biohacker, whether, you know, you have hundreds of thousands to spend or maybe only a couple thousand to spend, that kind of a thing.
Well, and looking at your app and your website, you know, the first time I looked at it, I thought, oh, is this going to be something that I hang, you know, put up to my face and it scans my body and gives me all this data? But no, it seems like I'll take my, let's say, my blood tests and all my medical records and put them, give the app access to them, I guess. And then using your AI technology, you evaluate my best options. Is that what I'm reading?
Yes. So there actually in that realm, there are some emerging technologies that kind of can scan your face and detect some things like, you know, heart rate variability and blood pressure, but it's like early stage yet. Yeah. But right now we're just depending on user provided data. So one way that you can do is actually connect to your smartwatch. So if you have like a Fitbit, Garmin, Apple Watch, that kind of a thing, you can connect those in, which that makes a continuous stream. And then we also have our, you know, general health surveys. And yeah, also importing lab reports too. And we'll continue to expand that data catalog as well of things that you can actually put in. And then underlying that is lots of scientific meta-analysis to kind of give you the statistical direction. And then we kind of overlay everything else on top of that.
So this is all very exciting, Jasmine. When is the app launching?
Yeah, so right now we are kind of you know, finalizing pretty much the AI algorithm is the most important part. So we're looking maybe end of year, early next year for that.
What are some of the challenges as you are trying to roll this out? Is it just the typical challenges you would have with anything? Or are you like, you know, finding that there are new features that you want to add to the app?
That was more like in the earlier stages. We did kind of have to have that thing where we wanted to do everything all at once. And then we have to kind of, okay, well, what can we do now? And then kind of roadmap it. And, you know, then it's like really just making sure that everything is super accurate and functioning the way that we really want it to. Because the aim is not just to, you know, put any old thing out there and, you know, talk it up and say, yes, it's going to do this and that. And then it really doesn't. We want it to work exactly how we imagine and say that it will. So we're just being very meticulous about that.
Jasmine, I was reading about you. And one of the things I really love about your bio is that you're an advocate for AI-driven democratized well-being, which I think is such a great thing, because so much of the biohacking world, like you said earlier, is very expensive and very sort of reserved for those who can truly afford all of the tests and the medicines and the treatments. How do you see Rejuve.ai really democratizing everybody's well-being?
Yeah, so one of the ways is, of course, that we are kind of launching our app globally. So anywhere that, you know, is pretty much legally allowed to have such a product, we will release there. And we're also, you know, advertising to all as well. So this is really an international, which will make it a really exotic data set as well, because there's not a lot of data sets available that actually have multiple regions in them. And then we're also giving people rewards in exchange for their data as well, which should defer the cost of a lot of the testing that's required to really get these really precise data points.
So your app is part of the, you're partnered with Rejuve Biotech, and you're creating longevity treatments. So I'm assuming that as people put in their data into the app, does that feed automatically into the Rejuve Biotech database to help them create new or possibly better treatments? And when I sign up for your app, do I know that that data is being fed into Rejuve Biotech?
Yeah, that's a good question. So one of the things that we promote too is the data ownership aspect. So we do make those things very transparent. At this time, yeah, there probably will be kind of a two-step thing. Like the initial, when you're signing up, is just agreeing to share your data with the Rejuve AI database. And then there'll be kind of a secondary thing. Do you also want to be part of, you know, Rejuve Bio experiments as well? And then of course, the idea is that once you're in there, you're kind of, you know, linked to what contributions that you made to various different projects, because in the future we might have other research entities that want to tap into this database too as it grows, and you always have that option to select whether or not you want to also share data with them.
Yes, Jasmine, going back to the hallmarks of aging, you reference these nine hallmarks of aging, and you've talked about it a little bit and suggested that, you know, part of it is having the resources, the financial resources to, for example, eat whole food all the time and have access to healthcare and things like that. It's hard because in the United States, as you say, it ranks dead last when it comes to life expectancy among high income countries. Could you just explore that a little bit more with us?
Yeah, so on the hallmark side, now there's actually 12. So we're going and updating that point as well. So a new paper came out in 2023 that added some additional ones. So that's an evolving space as well. But it kind of just gives the insights into these like kind of cellular and molecular processes that are actually happening that, you know, cause people to age, or that describe it better. And on the point about U.S. health span, well, I actually have like, I mean, it's becoming more popular now, but it wasn't as popular then, is that we have a lot of processed food in the United States, and a lot of ingredients in the food that are banned in a lot of the other, you know, high income countries. And I think since that's becoming more amplified and we get more and more data about that, we should hopefully see some changes there. And also, you know, encouraging people to, you know, start growing their own food perhaps, or, you know, trying to find, you know, these options of, you know, shorter ingredient lists and higher nutrient density, or perhaps even supplementing where the nutrients are deficient. But I mean, yeah, avoiding the ultra processed foods is probably the best thing that you can do to avoid that fate at this moment.
It's interesting. And I realize you're not a healthcare expert as the CEO of a tech company, but it does make me think about, you know, we talk a lot about people not, you know, people living in food deserts or people not having access to, or the pocketbook to be able to afford whole foods and stay away from processed foods. But, you know, I'm wondering where you have found in the literature, you know, if you eat mostly vegetables, even if you're buying fresh all the time, that it's not very expensive. And so I wonder if there are these myths out there that you're also trying to bust.
Well, actually, yeah, like, well, my background was in health information management. So I actually was like sort of translating all of the medical records into the, you know, the billing and coding side of pretty much calculating how much people's, you know, illnesses and things were worth. And that was not something really fulfilling. So that's another reason why I kind of got into longevity. But yeah, so there is a lot of fad diets like that, as you mentioned. I mean, one of the issues with, you know, I guess like, yeah, as you mentioned, like vegan diets and whatnot, is people don't consider the pesticide content. And then that goes back to the whole, you know, organic food pricing versus non and whatnot. One way that you can get around that is local produce. A lot of times you can probably find, you know, local farmers that may not have that organic label, but they're also, you might know that they're not spraying as many chemicals on it, perhaps, because I think that's where it becomes kind of the opposite of what you're trying to go for. If your vegetables and fruits are all saturated with chemicals, and they're not as healthy as they should be. And then there's the aspect of course, getting enough nutrient profiles in general. If you're not eating any animal products at all, you have to make sure that you are having proper levels of protein and other macronutrients.
Well, Jasmine, reading about the other main partners with your organization, one of them is your chief AI scientist, Dr. Ben Gortzel. And he, I was reading about him, and he talks about artificial general intelligence. I have not heard of AGI. What is that?
Oh, yeah. So AGI is actually, yeah, it's being more talked about now, but it is still a little bit niche. And it pretty much means the point to which an AI system is able to pretty much have the same level of intelligence as a human being. Now, today, some might be actually fooled by, you know, the systems like ChatGPT, because they do sound very fluent and intelligent, but they do make a lot of kind of core mistakes, and they are not at all human. They're really just it's a word calculator, pretty much. And so AGI is the point where it's actually, yeah, able to generalize upon, you know, knowledge as if it were a person, and actually kind of become its own agent in the system. So it's a kind of a theoretical point, but it's something that a lot of people are now increasingly believing may happen, and something that we should be aware of and be directing intentionally in a good direction.
So of course, my conspiracy mindset with AI goes to the area of, well, now we're giving it all this human data to help it become humanoid faster. But that's just how I think about some of this stuff. Well, your foundational organization is singularity.net. Tell us about that organization and how it plays into rejuve.ai.
Singularity.net Foundation started in 2018. It's a Web 3.0 based entity, which is like into cryptocurrencies and all of that. And it's all about this idea of AGI and AI and democratizing it so that more people around the world are contributing to this body of knowledge that AI is made up of, so that it's not only serving, you know, certain interests or people groups, but it's truly serving humanity. And there's also this thread of beneficial general intelligence that pretty much it has human-centric values and empathy and things of that nature. And that's how SingularityNet kind of came about. And then it kind of spun out into all of these different verticals, like computing and longevity, even music. They have digital twins. They have a band with a robot lead singer. It's pretty cool. So it has like probably like 20 or 30 different spinoff companies at various stages now. We were one of the earliest ones.
Okay. We're speaking with Jasmine Smith. She's the CEO of rejuve.ai. And as I'm looking at your website, which is very interesting, I notice that, and I love to hear about collaboration, and you are big collaborators with a lot of different, not only, you know, research companies, but vendors as well. And so I was wondering if you could go through, I'm looking through this list of, about 16 different vendors that are all in the healthcare space. The only one that I recognize is Garmin. So could you just talk about what helps you collaborate with different vendors, and what are they for?
The vendors are basically to provide products and services in the app that are in exchange for the tokens that people are earning in exchange for the data. So it's basically a way to direct you to the places that you want to go to get biological age tests, to obtain a wearable health tracker device, to obtain trusted supplements, all those kind of things. So everything that's going to help you to further your longevity journey. Another one on there is True Diagnostic, that kind of gained a bit more popularity recently as the Kardashians took this biological age test with them. So that one's on there, that tests your DNA methylation, which is basically how genes are being expressed at this current time. Which is different from whole genome sequencing. That's another provider on there called sequencing.com. And that tells you your baseline of what you were born with. So that's the two different elements. Genome is the kind of unchanged set, and then epigenome is what kind of changes based upon, you know, your lifestyle, environment, all that kind of a thing. We have other types of biological age tests. We have some supplement companies on there, like NMN is kind of a big one, a couple of those. And yeah, a couple of wearable devices. Mm-hmm. And then there's some other partners that are more research oriented, such as Open Cures, where we're just wanting to build like a web-based addition to our app as well. So that's there. So we're always open to all sorts of collaborations in the longevity and wellness space to optimize people's health journeys.
What I like about that, Jasmine, that I'm hearing is that there are so many options for us out there these days. And, you know, even in our little town here of Park City and the greater county, you have so many choices and you don't know. I mean, in my case, there were so many different choices for wellness and fitness that sometimes it makes me shut down completely and not do any of them, but just get out and like ride my bike or go on a hike.
And that's great too. Get out
there. Yeah. Yeah. Which is all great. But as there's more technology and more knowledge about, you know, epigenetics and things like that, it makes you desire something like this that kind of collects all of these resources in one place. And that's what I think sounds pretty cool about Rejuve AI, that it's an app that collects, that you've done all of the research already on what you believe are the best kind of resources to help you in your quest towards wellness and longevity. And I guess the question here is, how do you locate and how do you decide on these resources?
Yeah, so the ones that we kind of use by default are meta-analysis, which means studies that kind of the study of studies pretty much that combine a bunch of different data sets over many years and kind of statistically analyze, you know, what the ground scientific truths of this time are. Meta-analyses don't really come out that frequently. I mean, there's a lot of new papers coming out pretty much every single day that may be conflicting, but this method kind of, yeah, creates a baseline. And, you know, we use Bayesian inference, pretty much. That's our grounding model, our first AI model that we use. And so that's how we kind of track what the kind of best practices are. And then the idea is to fine tune it based upon new data that's coming in, of course, because all the data that's online is good, but it's not everything that possibly can be collected, of course. So
let's talk about the power use of all of this, because not only are you AI, but you're also blockchain. And there's been a number of papers coming out in research really showing the amount of electricity that ChatGPT is using, that AI is using. And we've already known about the amount of electricity that blockchain development uses. Are you guys working with any sort of other organizations to help offset that power use? Because it seems like this is a lot of data going into your system and possibly utilizing a lot of electricity.
Yeah, that is kind of a big concern about these emerging technologies, is being able to have more sustainable power solutions. I mean, I know in you know, one of the entities that SingularityNet is working with is trying to create kind of like these green smart cities. So that's one of the things. On our end, I mean, we're kind of at this time just utilizing regular AWS servers and whatnot. So nothing too fancy there. But yeah, we're always kind of in support of any of the latest, you know, for instance, being able to work with server farms that are using solar, for instance. Like, I'm very kind of open to that kind of a thing as well.
Well, and on your website, you talk about you've got a crowdfunding campaign going. Tell us about that, and what are you looking for in terms of support? Is it just monetary?
So actually, the crowdfunding is our sister company, Rejuve Biotech. And so, yeah, they have basically a license for these really long-lived fruit flies. That's one of the model organisms that are kind of studied alongside of a couple other ones like mice and C. elegans worms. And basically, the idea there is that they can run different experiments on those and then use AI transfer learning methods to learn things about human longevity as well. So it's like kind of this long-lived fly population that's been bred for, you know, probably over 20 years. So that's they're crowdfunding that effort on the biotech side, as they're going to be working on actual drug discovery type of things.
Yeah. Well, Jasmine Smith is the CEO of Rejuve AI. It's Rejuve, Rejuve.ai. If you'd like to look it up, a pretty robust website at this point. But Jasmine, is there another way that people can follow you since the app is not out yet, but will be in a few months?
On our site is kind of like the main hub to find all of the links, including our open beta. So we do have the beta testing available up until the point of launch, just to, you know, prove the concept and show that, you know, there really is an active community and how it's all structured and that it really is there. And then we have a list of all of our social media at the bottom. Our most active channels probably are our X or Twitter page, Telegram, and LinkedIn. So those are the kind of key channels that we are most active, but we're also on the other ones too, Facebook, Instagram, Discord, all that.
Jasmine, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. It's really an interesting world that we all ought to be tuned into. I mean, there's nothing bad about longevity, right?
Right, everyone wants to live longer, and I guess that's the key thing is that there's lots of ways that people can optimize their health span, which is you know how long you're actually healthy into later age, while we are kind of anticipating the technologies to actually possibly increase overall lifespan, which is the other side.
Absolutely. Okay, Jasmine, thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into Cool Science Radio here on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab on the KPCW app or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW Cool Science Radio. If you have ideas for a future show, email us at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org. And if you like today's episode, rate us, leave us a comment, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.